Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and novelist Gene Macken. Macken is the author of several historical novels, including The Sweet By and By, based on the 19th century spiritualist Maggie Fox, and The French Woman, based on a romance set in revolutionary France, as well as the Pennsylvania wilderness. Her new novel, just out this month from New American Library, is a historical novel based on the life of model-turned-photographer Lee Miller. It's called The Beautiful American, and it's a truly fascinating and beautifully written story that takes us from Paris in the 1920s to London after the Blitz, and along the way we meet Miller's lover Man Ray, as well as Pablo Picasso and many other vivid and colorful characters. Thank you for joining me, Gene.
Thank you, Tish. So happy to be here.
Now, the focus of The Beautiful American is the surrealist art scene in France in the 30s and so on. Did this era interest you specifically, or were you interested in Lee Miller and wrapped the story around that? Tell us how you came upon this.
Well, I was interested more specifically in the time and the time period as a lead-up to World War II, as opposed to the way it's sometimes presented as a kind of halcyon between the wars period. And I wanted to work with a plot that showed all of the different events that really made World War II the horrific, horrific event it was, especially in France. So it begins in the 20s, and of course it's based on the life of Lee Miller and the events in her life, so I stuck with her timeline. But I started it largely in France, in Paris, in the 20s, because of course I'm fascinated by that time. I mean, how could you not be? The art of it and the freedom of it and the recklessness of it was just breathtaking and wonderful to research and to kind of live in my imagination for a while.
Uh-huh. Did you find in any of your research that we have romanticized that period, though?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that there's so much that is left out of a lot of fiction or even popular histories of the time. Yes, it does get romanticized. I mean, it's something that fascinated me, and I've had a few minor hisses and spats with male artists about this, is you know, the surrealist attitude towards the female body. Surrealist art is a lot of fun, and it was a very significant, important movement, but it was also a very important movement in terms of developing a feminist consciousness, because it was not there.
And you talk about it in really stark language. I love that about this book. Now, the perfume industry is also a major character in this book. Tell us why the focus, and where did your interest come from?
Well, I love perfume, and I'm very aware of the moments when I'm able to enjoy perfume, because my sense of smell comes and goes a bit. Mm. And my father's did as well. And it actually, if you aren't able to smell things well, it actually creates a form of sensory deprivation that some people may not be aware of. It's not like losing vision or hearing where it really becomes apparent there's an issue here. You can lose your sense of smell and not really even be aware of it. And then suddenly you've fallen into a depression or other things start to go wrong. It's a very vital, important sense. And also Southern France, again, as someone who likes to use my imagination to live in other eras for at least part of the day, I got to live in Southern France for a while in the perfume industry. And I had traveled there before several times, and it's beautiful. Would want to be there.
And you use perfume, and as all of us do in our cultures, to evoke memory. And yes. To bring back, you know,
yes.
The memory of people and love and the
yes.
moments of our youth. And
yes. One thing that goes on with a lot of contemporary perfume is that one of its base notes is baby powder, because it's supposed to appeal to, you know, the baby boom generation, and I actually hate the smell of baby powder.
I do too.
And trying to find a perfume that does not have baby powder as a note is a real challenge. But yeah, perfume, it's like, you know, Proust Madeline, isn't it? It's one of those things that connects us to the world as a physical place.
I found it interesting that really was a main character in the book. Now, let's talk about the base of the story. The main focus, of course, is Lee Miller and her childhood friend, Nora Tours. Am I saying her name right?
Yes.
Nora Tours. Lee Miller is a real character. Nora was somebody you made up in your imagination.
Right.
But they both seem so vivid to me. How did you do that?
Thank you. How did I do it?
Yeah, I mean, how did you make this woman come as alive as a real person?
This is going to take time to think about. I think probably in the same way that I made Lee come alive, because Lee, although based on a real person, also functions as a fictional character because it is a novel. But I do a lot of what I call back writing, where you try to imagine what was this person's first
fifth birthday like?
What did this person enjoy or hate about high school? What was her relationship like with her father? What events did they share that created their relationship? You treat them like real people, and you ignore the fact that you actually are creating their memories. When I used to teach creative writing, I used to say that when you write historical fiction, you have to be able to write it from memory.
Ah.
Because if you feel like you're inventing it, it will read like an invention. But if you are writing from memory, just as you would in nonfiction, then it does tend to have that real quality to it. And a lot of that is the back writing, the back story.
That's really interesting, because a lot of theater technique has somebody creating a character and you have to decide where they went to school and how they felt about their parents.
Yeah,
it's the same thing as like creating a character for the stage.
Well, you know, I think writing fiction has a lot to do with acting, because you do inhabit those characters, or they inhabit you as you're working on them. I have a friend who's an actor, and we used to compare notes. You know, what does this character do when she's nervous? Does she pace? Does she fume? When you're creating a character on stage, it really is very similar to creating one on the page. Yeah. They both use settings. Physical gestures, you know, it's very similar.
You know, I got the sense when I was reading the novel that maybe Nora Tours was based a little bit on somebody you knew, a little bit on maybe yourself. I felt such sympathy for her. I felt like I knew her better than I knew Lee Miller in the book, which was really interesting.
She is the narrator. I wanted to write in first person because I love using that voice, but I did not want to use Lee Miller as the narrator of her own story.
Mm-hmm.
And so Nora was created to be the alter ego and the narrator, as well as probably main character, although she shares equal weight with Lee, really, emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
The character, it's not really based on any of my life experience or even my own emotional history. I think Nora is actually a lot more easygoing than I am. But I thought a lot of my high school days and my high school friends when I was creating Nora, because I did grow up in a very, very small town, which had an almost Brigadoon quality to it. It missed a lot of what was going on in the larger world. Mm-hmm. So some of the people I grew up could easily have had that very small town earlier mindset that Nora has. And I have to admit, too, I'm not saying that because I'm deriding it in any way. I had, in many ways, a very idyllic childhood, one that I could wish on other people. Mm-hmm. And I wanted that sense of kind of small-town niceness to also come through with Nora.
Yeah, and it absolutely does. Now, in some ways, the fact that you place this in around World War II and stuff, you could be talking about living people in the here and now, right? People who are still alive. How'd you navigate that? Did you meet anybody who knew Man Ray and Lee Miller and talk to them?
No, the actual characters are all based on print research. I didn't try to do archival research or interviews because of the amount of time it would have taken, and also it would have limited my imagination and what I was able to do with them. So, that's mostly research on what was already known about them.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part was writing something so close to me historically, because my other fictions have been in the 18th, 19th century, even mm-hmm. one in the 12th century, and that felt very, very strange to me, knowing that there are people alive who experience some of these events. And in a way, if anything could give me writer's block, that would, you know, the possibility of someone saying, you got that wrong. But, you know, it is a novel, and much of it is invented, although based in fact. But it was strange working so close to that timeline. And I partially did it as a tribute to my father, who was in World War II. And I've always wanted to write about the war as experienced by family rather than soldiers.
Yeah. That's an interesting take in this book, too, that I noticed. Now France is often a focus of a lot of your books. And I know your mother came from French families, right? So tell us about that. You inherited a love for France.
My mother's family was French Huguenot.
Mm.
And they've been here several generations. And when I was in high school in my wonderful small town high school, there weren't that many choices of language. I studied Latin and French, and I think that's all that was offered.
Mm.
Eventually, Spanish was offered as well. But there's something about France that I think speaks to me and to many people as well, and it may go back to, you know, your earlier question, do we romanticize this a bit? In France, we definitely do romanticize, which is not to say it isn't a wonderful place. It is. I visit whenever I can.
And I've been there several times, too.
Yeah, it's wonderful. There's something in it that speaks to so many people in so many ways. And France was, for a long time, a very important hub of all that we valued in culture.
Mm-hmm.
The food, the art, the literature, the language, which is still a global language.
And the cafe
language.
Culture. The I mean, that's the part
culture.
Of it that was really romanticized
yeah,
for so many people.
The cafe culture. Because we really didn't have that in this country until pretty recently in our own history. And there's something so appealing about cafe culture, mm-hmm. where you're working in isolation, as writers do, but you're working in a crowd. And
yeah.
that's fabulous.
But I, you know what I like about the cafe culture that we don't really, well, we didn't up until the last 20, 30, 40 years? The fact that cafe culture can bring people together.
Absolutely.
It's a way
yes.
to connect with
yeah.
people, and,
yeah.
and you don't have to work 24 hours a day the way so many Americans do. You can actually enjoy your culture and your neighbors, which I loved about
right.
it, too. And you portray this so well. But, of course, the people are artists, which is a stereotype that people have of,
right.
of Americans going to France. Now, I want to talk about Lee Miller a little bit more, because she was obviously brave and very different kind of woman for her era. But I don't know if I really would like her.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? There was something about her that was incredibly hard.
Yes.
To talk to us a little bit about her.
Should I talk a little bit about her early years?
If you,
she was
sure.
raped as a child mm-hmm. at the age of 7, at a time when, to begin with, people didn't even talk about it, much less put you through support therapy or anything else to deal with it. It was kept behind locked doors, and the families dealt with it as best they could, if they dealt with it at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And from what I read of Lee Miller and her family, her father, who was a very intelligent, talented, free-thinking individual, I believe decided that to help his daughter cope with what had happened to her, he would encourage her to be as free and brave as possible. And that at a time when men and women lived very, very different lives,
yeah,
and
yeah.
women were not expected to be free and brave in the way that Lee Miller was. And it did give her a kind of hardness, and the rape left scars emotionally and physically, and I'm sure they were part of her psychological composition. And working with Leah, I admit it took me a while to warm up to her as well.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
she's.
Uh-huh.
It took me a while. And by the time I got to the end of the first draft, I was just in love with this woman. You know, I don't mean in any kind of sapphic way, but I loved her strength, her willingness to get on with life, and her bravery. In World War II, she was famous for getting to battle scenes before the soldiers
yeah,
did.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
And the only way a woman could do that, number one, was by breaking rules, which of course she did.
Mm-hmm.
But her bravery was just breathtaking.
Yeah, and she also insisted on, even though she was connected to all these high-powered, highly successful creative men, she insisted on being able to portray her creativity as well in the world, which I found really,
she
really
interesting.
She
stood up to men at a time when many women, many bright, talented women, were still content to settle for being their models
yeah.
and their girls back in the apartment. She stood up for her rights, and she often did them one better.
Yeah, yeah. How did you discover Lee Miller? I, of course, have heard of Man Ray.
Well, some of Lee's final work before she finally gave up photography completely was in the A Life of Man exhibit.
Ah.
And I had known her work through that, and I am married to an artist who also does photography, so I tried to educate myself a little bit about it. And one of my best friends when I lived in Boston was a photographer, and I know that it's an art form for which I have absolutely no skill whatsoever, and I've always admired the photograph, and I think to some extent that photography is the art of the 20th century. Whereas, you know, oil painting was the art of the Renaissance and prints the art of perhaps the 17th century. I think photography most shaped the thinking of the 20th century.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Jean Mack, and we're talking about her new book, The Beautiful American. It's about Lee Miller, the photographer Lee Miller from the 20s and 30s. Let's talk a little bit more about the way you wrote about Man Ray and the Surrealist movement and how sexist it was and how it objectified women. Talk to me more about that. I hadn't really heard that many people talk in those ways about that time, even though I felt it too, the way women's body parts were just being portrayed.
If you think of Man Ray's two most famous images, the first is the early one of his lover Kiki, with her back to the viewer and fret holes painted on her back so that her body becomes a cello, an object. And one of the later images of the lips floating in the sky that he did several times, and it is Lee Miller's mouth. And again, it's just her mouth. It's not Lee Miller the person, it's Lee Miller's mouth.
Yeah.
And the images are memorable and important and iconoclastic, but they are of parts of woman or woman as objects. And to some extent, that's the way women have always been viewed in art, and probably to some extent always will. There's a wonderful book by John Berger called Ways of Seeing that talks about women are for looking at. And he explains it well. You don't get angry when you read his book. He explains it very well. And women are beautiful. They are for looking at. And bodies are beautiful and for looking at. But women in particular, to some extent, certain works of art are acts of control over women.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that comes through in a lot of the surrealist art.
Yeah.
One of the points I tried to bring out in the book, too, is that the surrealist art, in a way, was, like all good art, it had a real definite place and mission for what it was doing, because it did make people think. That's why it's memorable. And the violence in some of the art was also, I think, predictive of World War II. And I didn't even think of that until I went back for this book and started looking at the surrealist art all over again. And there was such violence in some of it, in addition to the objectifying of the body.
So you feel like it was prescient, almost, in regard to World War II?
I do. I think they picked up on something that was in the air that other people were not really recognizing yet that was there.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I really loved about this novel, too, were the undertones that you could feel. You know, even when they were enjoying themselves in Paris as artists and living their fantasy life, you felt a darkness. And I think the way you portrayed it was the coming of the war and this fragmented art, and it's very interesting. Was that hard for you to convey? Did you think consciously about it?
I did work it in consciously. I don't think it was hard to convey because I knew that, in a way, this is my war novel. But, you know, on the other hand, I have to point out that almost every book I've written has had a war in it. And I realize I've become to be obsessed with war. It is one of the constants, one of the ongoings in this thing we have called humanity. And one thing that drives me to write historical fiction is that I'm fascinated by how public events create private lives.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is what the darkness of the war was. And, you know, when I was working with the characters, I would think, well, what would this character be like if this hadn't happened? And I couldn't really think of them without those specific events. They would be working in a void, and you can't. And there was such darkness in that time. Such darkness.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have to do a lot of research, or did you already know a lot? Because, it is pretty contemporary. And it's amazing when I think about how recent it really was.
Not that old. yes, I did have to do quite a bit of research. Mm-hmm. I try, you know, while I like to, when I'm sitting at the desk writing my first draft, I like to have the sense of writing from memory. But in the afternoon, when I'm doing the editing and the other chores of the work, I have shelves and shelves of reference books that I keep going back to try to keep things right, to keep them correct.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, what attracts you to historical fiction, though? I mean, it seems to me one would want to write a real history and or just a plain fiction about some of these times. Well, what is it that the combination so has taken your imagination?
Perhaps I don't write the nonfiction history because when I was in high school and college, most nonfiction history books were written to put you to sleep at night, as far as I could tell.
Yeah.
I did not like history in college.
Mm-hmm.
I had a minor in it, but most of the books I thought were very strangely emphasized on not just dates, because dates do matter, but on political events. Mm. And I always wondered, well, where are the people?
Yeah, where's the
where
culture?
Are the people who are going through these events? Whereas the books were always about the people creating the events, and I did not want to spend my life as a scholar. I did not want to spend 20 years researching one nonfiction book.
Yeah.
My imagination just gets too restless for that.
Yeah. And then this gives you the freedom, right? I mean,
exactly.
It gives you the best of both worlds in many ways, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of freedom.
Now, do you think you might also be attracted to historical fiction because the here and now is so chaotic and hard to put your finger on until it's past?
I think it may partially be that because I'm very story-driven in my work, and it's hard for me to look around my daily life and see the story. And I don't know why that is. It's like I prefer vanilla to chocolate. There's no explanation for it. But I quite often, I'm not seeing a narrative in what's going on around me.
Okay, so current events are just flying past Jean Mackin, right?
I'm paying a lot of attention to them. Believe me, I vote. You know, the subjects I choose all have parallels in what's going on now.
What goes around comes around, kind
exactly,
of philosophy. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. You know, that old chestnut that we do repeat history over and over and over again. And I guess writing historical fiction is an act of hope that maybe someone will say, oh, yeah, we tried that and it didn't work. But, yeah.
I don't think anybody's hearing that.
Yeah.
Was there anything that surprised you in some of the research you did for this book? Because it is a specific time. It starts and then it ends at a specific time. And anything that you didn't know that you found out in your research?
Well, not a specific date or fact, but what surprised me was the overall tone. And I didn't even catch on to that until after my editor had read a draft. I was worried about the time scope. I mean, it really encompasses quite a bit of time. And my editor said, I really like that. I don't see that as a problem. I like how it moves from event to event leading up to the war. Mm. And when I had written the book in those earlier drafts, I hadn't even really been aware that I was doing that. But looking back at it, and now I see what I did was I took the 20s and the 30s and refused to treat them as a period of isolation, which I think is part of the romanticism that you were talking about. The 20s were so much fun, weren't they? Well, in fact, the 20s were a result of World War I, and they helped lead into the Depression, which helped cause World War II.
Exactly.
So actually, they weren't that much fun.
Exactly. Do you see yourself taking any of the characters from this novel and turning them into another novel, like perhaps Nora's daughter?
Her daughter. She's an academic. My heavens, what story.
You know, I find some of the characters in the book could be developed beyond where we saw them, you know.
Yeah, Nora's daughter is her main part in this novel is when she's very young. And I had kind of wondered what would she be like in her grown-up and mature years. And she is there, but it's kind of, you know, the conclusion of the story of when she's a child. And I did kind of find her interesting in that she becomes one of these wonderful bi-coastal people who really does fly back and forth to France 3 or 4 times a year. People I grew up so jealous of, you know. Now I couldn't do because I can't fly that much. But I thought it would be fun to consider a character like her who is so, in that way, contemporary, bi-continental, but no, I haven't yet. I don't know if I will.
What's next for you, though? Are you working on a new novel?
I am working on a new novel, and we just got the title of it, which I'm not going to give you.
Okay.
But it's set earlier than The Beautiful American, in the end of the 19th and the early part of the 20th century, and Edith Wharton is one of the characters in it, though not the main character. Edith had a niece, Beatrix Ferrand, who became the first recognized professional female landscape architect in this country. And I'm working her into a character, and she's lovely. She's wonderful. She's wonderful.
Do you, when you find yourself involved in a novel, do you start living in these worlds? Is it hard for you to walk out your front door and come back to reality?
On a good day, yeah. I mean, on a good day, you want to stay there. Beatrix fascinates me because I am a gardener. I mean, I have a garden now. I've been working for more than 30 years, and I know the roses as well as I know some of the people, you know, what their weaknesses are and what they're going to look like and how well they'll last. And to try to work that into fiction is interesting. It's kind of like what I was working with when I was trying to write about sense of smell as you know, this personal issue for myself that now has to become fictionalized. And I'm doing that with gardening, and you know, we'll see what happens.
You know what I want to ask you, too, about the current novel? What do you want people to take away from this? Does a historical fiction writer want people to go research the real history? How do you want people to react to
The Beautiful
your books?
American?
Yes,
the
current
really
novel.
Hoping people will go back and look at Lee Miller's photography. Mm. It is astounding. And in many ways, leading into so many trends that followed, and the trends that she wasn't leading on, but following the photojournalism of war. Her photographs are breathtaking. She was so very, very talented. And I'm so, you know, in a way, maternally proud that she had the sense to recognize her own talent and not just be a model. She knew she belonged behind the camera.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, beautiful women often can be content to merely be beautiful women, and she did not do that.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping they'll look at her work.
And what about the research you did, you obviously unveiled a whole bunch of women that are unknown because they were the mistresses of Picasso and so on. I love the detail. I mean, you had the right mistress, Francoise Gillot, or whatever her name was. Was that how you say it?
Right.
During that period, we all know Picasso had so many lovers. Did it make you want to start doing more research on some of the obscure women of that history?
It did, actually. Francoise is fascinating.
She is.
She was a law student. Brilliant, brilliant.
And
woman.
She wrote that fascinating book, Life of Picasso.
Yeah. I read quite a few of the Picasso biographies, and some of them were so much fun and some of them were so bitter. But yeah, Francoise is fascinating. She deserves, I shouldn't give this, cut that out.
She deserves what?
She deserves her own novel.
There we go. It's
gave that away.
but you do hope people will take from this novel and go research some of the real characters in it. Some of the real characters in it. Does working on a novel like this change you in any way as a writer or a person? Do you feel like it enriches your life quite a bit to be able to work for years on these?
Yeah, I mean, it adds so much to my life that I actually start to get depressed if I'm not working on a novel.
Mm.
It's something that I don't do it because I've chosen to do it. I feel like I do it because I have to do it.
Yeah.
I really do get depressed if I'm not working on a book. And I actually think there might be a physiological reason for it. I think that when I am working on those fictions, I'm using a part of my brain that doesn't get used any other way. I really believe that.
Wow, that's really interesting. So I can't say whether it's the left or the right side of your brain, but it's probably using the whole brain. It's creative and analytical and so on.
It is. It's problem solving. You don't learn how to write a novel. You learn how to write the novel, and then you go on and learn how to write the next novel. Every step of writing fiction for me is a problem solving step.
Is one of the favorite things for you in writing these kinds of novels is doing the research?
I love doing research, yeah. I could go into a library and never come out again.
I know you just retired as a teacher. You taught creative writing at Goddard for many years. What kind of advice do you give to aspiring writers now that you've got quite a few novels under your belt?
To take the work seriously and professionally, not to wait for inspiration. That's how novels don't get written, because I think inspiration is likely to occur if you're already at your desk. So people who sit around waiting for it usually are the people who spend a long time waiting and don't write. But also to be true to the work, to not be so concerned about what is popular at the given moment, because in all likelihood, if your book is published, it might be 5 years down the road and the given moment will be long over. So, you know, to be true to the work and to take it seriously and to keep reading. I can't stand it when people say, I want to write, and then they say, but I don't read.
Oh, that's just ridiculous.
You know, I don't think it even can work. I don't trust people who say that.
Well, Jean Mackin, we are almost out of time. Do you have any contact information people can get in touch with, website or?
Yeah, my website is www.jeanmackin.com, and it's JeanMackin.
Well, Jean Mackin, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure. And again, the book is called The Beautiful American, just out from the New American Library. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.